This is reality proves possibility. We can do better than this. Welcome to another edition of Reality Proves Possibility. We can do better than this. And I'm honored to be with David Sloan Wilson, who has been a hero of mine in doing much of the intellectual groundwork that we're using for what we call humanistic management. And thank you, David, so much for being here with us. I'm just asking you generally, like, what is your response in terms of when you hear we can do better than this? What's your reaction? And how do you think we can? Because you have been working on this new paradigm for a long, long time. And I think that's really a key foundation that can guide us to do better than what we're currently experiencing.
Yeah, my response is that nothing is working, not left, not right, not libertarian. We really need something different. And it's not nudging. I think, you know, there was a time when behavioral economics was the new big thing, and it was summarized by the word nudge. And I think that's a great word to say we need to do something that goes way beyond nudging. We need something that's truly different. And so many people think that. And when things are crumbling all around us or on fire, then, of course, that's the natural way to think and to search for something that's truly different. But what's encouraging and what makes me a hopeful person is that that something that's truly different actually is at hand. And so I think that rather than just embarking upon some search, we really have something to offer that is truly different. The way to think about it is a maturation of something that stretches back for a long way, which is a combination of complex system science and evolutionary science. So we could go into the weeds with that, but happy to go into those weeds. But first thing to say is that nothing has been working, not left. You know, I mean, if Kamala Harris had won the election, and I really wish she had, but still, the prescriptions that have marked progressive politics and economics are part of the problem, and so maybe things are going to get so bad that there'll be some kind of phoenix that can rise from the ashes, and that's what keeps me a hopeful person.
Great. And if you want to explore a little bit more, what do you see is the problem that we are currently facing? And you describe it as the archipelago, and your vision of a more unified grand paradigm that can help steer us all in a better direction, where we already have evidence, and you have evidence, collected evidence, that this actually works better. It is already working, and it's been actually the key to our evolutionary success so far. So reality proves possibility. So what is it that you see your grand vision?
Well, work most recently with my economist colleague, Dennis Snower, but dating back from our 15 years, there's two critiques that are needed. One is the wrong paradigm, neoclassical economics. Everyone loves to critique neoclassical economics. One thing you can say about it is that it is a paradigm. It is an interlocking set of ideas. You can do math on it. It does connect macro to micro to macro in its own way. And so a paradigm is an interlocking set of ideas. And however much you might dislike neoclassical economics, at least you have to credit it for being a paradigm. One that leads in a terribly the wrong direction. So critique number one is the wrong paradigm. Critique number two is no paradigm. That's just like 1,000 different perspectives that do not cohere with each other. And it's for that I have the metaphor of an archipelago, many, many islands of thought and practice with little communication among islands. That's what is opposing the neoclassical paradigm right now. And it's so fascinating. You know, I sometimes do this when I give a talk to my audience. I say, Name some person that's been really influential in your life. Who's the giant upon whose shoulders you are standing? And then name that person to the person sitting next to you and see if that person has even heard of your giant. And then I name some of my own giants. I ask, who's heard of Eleanor Ostrom? Who's heard of Stephen C. Hayes? And invariably in an audience, most of the people have not heard of my giants. So there's your archipelago that you can be a rock star on your island and totally unknown beyond its borders. Something must be done about that. So what's new is something that counts as a paradigm, another paradigm, and that something, perhaps unsurprisingly, is a combination of two bodies of knowledge. One is complex system science, and the other is evolutionary science. And these have long roots, but have only matured in the last 50 years. That's what makes them new and old at the same time. And so that's the new paradigm, which provides an alternative to both the wrong paradigm and no paradigm.
Yeah, perfect. And can you just give us like the 30 seconds pitch of the new paradigm? What are the interlocking ideas? We know them for neoclassical economics. It's homo economicus, perfect rationality, perfect markets, maximization of utility, aka profit, GDP, et cetera, et cetera. What is your sort of set of interlocking ideas?
Well, I guess again, all of this has to be telegraphic, but I think there's a lot that stands behind it. So I'm pumping out stuff all the time, and so are others. I'm not the only one here, friends. Not at all. These are whole communities that are doing this. But I think, the fatal error of the neoclassical paradigm, and you have to go back to the beginning of the profession and really to the beginning of the Enlightenment to know that people that were so bent on placing the study of humanity on a scientific foundation. And at that time, that meant Newton and his laws of motion. Newtonian physics was what science represented. And so the idea of a physics of social behavior was the great goal, the great holy grail, you might say. And to do that, you had to represent individuals as some kind of atom. And that's where like self-interest became. So basically what you were trying to do is you were trying to build some idea of human society, including economics, but more generally human society, as built out of atoms, individuals, who were entirely self-interested. That's where hedonism comes in, Jeremy Bentham, and this idea that economic activity is motivated entirely by self-interest, which dates back to the very beginning. Figures such as David Ricardo, this stretches back to the beginning. And so it's really a hopeless quest in the first place to represent people as some kind of atom with fixed preferences that are not influenced by other people, and then to think that those atoms are somehow motivated entirely by their own self-interest, and then somehow to build for that to lead in the direction of a society or an economy that works well. It's a hopeless quest. And against that, so we might ask, is there any other scientific foundation? And the answer is yes, it's Darwin's theory of evolution. And that leads you on a completely different path, and one which includes the major question of how can cooperation, prosociality, societies that function well as societies, evolve by a Darwinian process. And so it's the Darwinian paradigm that we are basing this on. And it hinges fundamentally on the question of basically the evolution of cooperation and also the realization that our species is a highly cooperative species, an ultra cooperative species. So the whole theory gets based on cooperation. It becomes historically based. And what it tells us that we must do is we must select whole systems. That's our object of selection. and individuals fit within the larger complex system. It really is paradigmatically different.
Okay, so basically cooperation, we are social, and how do we guide collaboration and cooperation is an evolutionary process with the what are the elements? Can you just sort of specify what are the elements of that evolutionary process through the lens of the Darwinian pro-social approach? Can you?
So again, Michael, and we talk about this all the time, so our challenge is to communicate it to our audience in this very brief moment of time. And one way to do that is to, first of all, ask, what does micro look like from the standpoint of the new paradigm? And in neoclassical economics, micro is the self-regarding individual, the individual with its own preferences that are not influenced by the preferences of other individuals. In the new paradigm, micro are individuals that exist within groups. So just think of a small group and reflect on the fact that throughout our entire evolutionary history, individuals never ever lived alone. They always lived in the context of small and appropriately structured our groups. They always could rely on social resources in addition to their own personal resources. They were always guided by norms. Their preferences were very much influenced by other individuals. Everything that we associate with morality in terms of expectations on how to behave and punishment if you don't, the motive to help others, the altruistic, sympathetic, compassionate motive. That's the building block. That's micro from the standpoint of the new paradigm. And even before we graduate to macro, just think of the tremendous good that we can achieve by helping individuals function in the context of small, purposeful, and appropriately structured groups. It very much merges with Robert Putnam. And I think most of your audience will know that giant. interesting. Now, if you have never heard of Robert Putnam, then that's a demonstration of my archipelago metaphor. But Robert Putnam is world famous, his book Bowling Alone, for stressing the importance of small groups and their deterioration in modern life. And I actually have a podcast with him that we can refer to in the notes, in which we discuss basically what Alexis de Tocqueville meant by self-interest, rightly understood. So there's micro. And then as we build up to macro, we do it in stages. There's meso. There's all these kinds of social identities and groups that exist in human societies that are necessary.
And you call it multi-level, right? So there's multiple levels of that, yes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it dovetails very much with another term, polycentric governance, and that's associated with Eleanor and Vincent Ostrom, more giants that you might or might not know. But it's so commonsensical, Michael. Here's what polycentric governance is. It says, number one, life consists of many spheres of activity. Number two, each sphere has an optimal scale, which is often quite small. Number three, good governance requires finding the optimal scale for each sphere and appropriately coordinating them among the spheres. How could this not be true? And yet it's not how governance typically takes place. And at any level, any grouping, no matter what the scale, there's certain structure, certain what we call core design principles that help those groups function as cooperative units. It's like a universal set of principles that are needed for cooperation in all their forms. I won't list them here because let's just keep things short, but please know that they exist and that any group can function better by employing these simple principles, which are make just common sense from the standpoint of the new paradigm. And then another thing is to be adaptable. All groups need two things. One is to be well-governed And the other is to be adaptable, capable of change. And today, all individuals and groups vary in their adaptability. Some individuals and groups are lucky to be already adaptable, but many others are not. And so we can teach governance and we can teach adaptability, and every person and group should want to know about this.
Right. And in some way, you create the process of like pro-social, being pro-social, creating variation, adaptation, and sort of then look at the scale in a way where what are the processes that are adapted that then allow for a certain outcome, which is different in which sphere you're operating, potentially, right, to be achieved. So it's a process focus in terms of the variation and the adaptation.
It's very much process focused. Basically, evolution has three ingredients. First of all, there's some target of selection. If evolution is intentional, we're trying to do something. That something is very systemic. Number two, we need to figure out what to do. So we need to consider alternatives. There's your variation. And then we need to identify what works best, and we need to preserve it and replicate it. Realizing that it will always be sensitive to context. So this is actually not a cookie cutter solution. So that's what evolution is, selection, variation, replication. We spin that again and again and again at all scales. As an individual, you need to spin that for yourself. Then we need to spin that in small groups. And we need to spin it in larger groups. And we have to note that evolution has a perverse way of turning cooperation into selfishness. That if I want to do things for my own good, then often that can become self-serving. And if a group is cooperating well, it might sometimes be doing so while harming other groups. And so cooperation has a way of permuting into selfishness. And so the only solution to that is to make sure that not only are we internally cooperative if we're in a group and that group is internally cooperating, that group must also be a pro-social agent in its interactions with other groups all the way up to the planet. And so one fundamental implication is that everything we do must be coordinated for the global common good. And if it doesn't, then it becomes cancerous at some lower scale. So this ends up with a whole earth ethic. And all of that, I think you can see, Michael. In fact, I might ask you to take your turn, converges with what we mean by humanistic management, I believe. And so maybe I think you should take your turn and then connect the dots, basically, as to how this, what I've been describing as an evolutionary approach, just meshes so very well with the tradition of humanistic management.
Thank you. And I think what is sort of for me the key piece here, we're focusing on a process that's universal, right? And that can be applied at multiple level: individual, group, organization, society. You say whole Earth, right? Planetary. And therefore, I think it's so empowering because we face these multi-level issues. And I think what we call polycrisis is a manifestation that we don't really have an answer to how to address these issues, because the current way of thinking is rooted in this individual that actually just wants to do things for themselves. And humanistic management basically is the starting point. We are driven by at least four independent drives. One of them is social. One of them is oriented towards meaning and comprehension, which is important. The other one is safety, and the other one is acquisition. And those need to be addressed in many ways. And I would say that currently what we've been doing, like we have done that in history over time, is like we have focused on the maximization of one of these needs. And therefore we create this imbalance. And so right now the consequences of focusing on the drive to acquire ad nauseum is causing this imbalance. And what's happening is that people want to get back into this social grouping, which was sort of the source, in combination with the maximization of your ideology, whether it was socialism, Nazism, or some other form of meaning making, that caused these major conflicts. And then we sort of learned that maximization of your own group is not very good. Maximization of your own ideology is not necessarily very helpful. But you need to have some kind of balance, and social democracy, whatever we would call it, was sort of allowed for that kind of balancing act. And it didn't address the other issues well enough, unfortunately, or wasn't very clearly powerful in terms of like countering some of these tendencies of like maximizing your wealth acquisition. And so it's getting eroded in that way, because, well, it seems like the system that we call neoclassical, or that sort of the Washington consensus, is clearly failing at this point. And we just say this is a failure of management. This is a failure of how you govern at multiple levels. So that's where the process comes in. It's like, okay, well, if you have people be a little bit, I have an understanding of people being a little bit more complex, but more accurate, you have a better foundation for theory, right? You need parsimony, you need accuracy. But then you need to understand who we are as people to then create the kind of conditions that we actually want. And ultimately, if utility maximization is translated into human flourishing, we wouldn't have a problem. But how do we capture human flourishing as utility? And right now the measures are off. So we're just basically saying, if the measure is human flourishing, we would manage differently, and we see management as a balancing act, not as a maximization act. So if you get those kind of things in place with the process that you're describing, a cultural evolution, and you see that as an integration of multiple levels, then I think you have a realistic shot of looking at what works. Organizations that work, societies that work, groups that work, people that individually flourish. We have all the evidence over time. They live longer, they are happier, et cetera, et cetera. So That's the riff on what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and I think I have a good way to finish up our conversation, Michael, by showcasing the work that we're doing together. Mm-hmm. And we need to emphasize the need for both inner and outer work. I think very often, mm-hmm. as you know, when we work on such things as flourishing and so on, we kind of, without knowing what we're doing, we describe it as an individual endeavor, and we try to get individuals to be in a state of mind that leads to flourishing, mm-hmm. without realizing that there is a whole sort of external social environment that has to be designed along with it. And what we did, for the benefit of our listeners, we did some experiments with business students at the Gabelli School of Business at Fordham University, forming them into teams. And those teams had a challenging objective to, what was the objective? It was to
consult to a company and then present to judges about their solution. So basically it's called the consulting cup, where they are evaluated based on their consulting approach.
Right. And so we had a performance outcome for these student teams. Mm-hmm. And we measured them for whether they had implemented these core design principles that I mentioned, and which would lead to performance. So there is a kind of a business performance aspect. And what we showed was that not only did the teams that implemented the core design principles succeed making it into the semifinals of this competition, but the members of those teams scored higher on flourishing, So there was a connection between the structure of the group as a highly cooperative group and the state of mind of the individuals. They had achieved a higher level of flourishing. And so there's a microcosm there that I think can be extended to many, many other contexts, that if we're going to achieve flourishing and also achieve groups that work well, then we can do both of those by focusing on both our inner states of mind and our outer social structures. We can do this. This is like, I like to say, shovel ready, that even though it's a new paradigm, it is truly shovel ready for any organization, any context. That's another point to make with back to my archipelago. These ideas apply across all islands, and so they provide a common language It doesn't matter whether it's business or education or the environment, you name it, it requires cooperation in groups. And so this is truly shovel ready. And I would think that anyone who's listening to this who just wants to check that out, then we can provide more. And I think we should consider this podcast as an invitation.
Yeah. Do you want to just share like the address, I think, is prosocial.net. Is that correct? Can you?
Prosocial.world, www.prosocial.world. But better, I think, contact either one of us because this is an ecosystem, basically, that we're trying to build. And the ecosystem consists of many worthy organizations and social networks. And so these ideas, certainly my own organization is a hub, but so is yours. And we're working together. So I think what you need to do is join a network. And ProSocial World, if you want to email hello@prosocial.world, then you'll get some attention from our organization.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think maybe it's worth to sort of close this off with just like the invitation, as what you and I are doing together. We're supporting this transmission of a new paradigm, a new possibility, because reality proves possibility. This is not just theory. This is actually informing theory, and Alan Ostrom's work and others' work is actually coming from observing practice of that which works. So it's reality that informs theory. It's not theory that gives you the lens to look at reality, but it's very powerful. And unfortunately, that's the problem that we are currently having. We have these lenses that we are not aware of, and we're trying to force reality into that and then hope for these outcomes that are just not fitting with these glasses. And so rather than doing that, we're looking at the best of what already is. And it shows us, like from evolution, that's how we have been surviving. All right, so maybe you want to learn something about organizing better from which has produced results. So that's the fascinating piece that I see how our work is connecting. And I think that really can help other organizations and groups and individuals to either have more confidence or maybe more ways of collaboration or better ways of achieving the outcomes that they're ultimately going for. And I think that's really that's what makes this powerful, and we can do better than what we're currently doing. So
and it brings us back to the concept of paradigms. What we need is beyond nudging, and the wonderful thing about paradigms is that it really is like, you know, switching glasses or switching eyes or whatever, and it creates a new common sense. And very famously, when Thomas Huxley first learned about Darwin's theory of natural selection, he said, "How stupid of me not to have thought of that." And I think there's a sense in which you adopt this new stance, this new paradigm, these new lenses, and you look back and you say, "How stupid of us not to have thought of that." That's how commonsensical it all becomes. And I think that, and then you can immediately put it to use. In fact, the evidence for it is just hiding in plain sight. It's all around us. Isn't that nice to know? You know, I mean, we could get religious. This is like the born again experience is exactly that. When you're born again as a religious believer, you've swapped something out. You've taken your old self and you've swapped it for something new, and you feel born again. So isn't it interesting that without being religious at all, we can say that there is a kind of a born again experience that you can have by exchanging one economic paradigm for another.
Yeah, well, and that's a rebirth, a renaissance, right? A renaissance. That's what we're sort of connecting oftentimes with the humanistic perspective of like seeing ourselves differently. So thank you so much, David, for being here. Everybody that's listening here, we're curious to see how you're putting some of these things in place, what questions you have. If you want to be connected, please feel free to reach out at the Humanistic Management Association or at prosocial.world. And thank you so much, David, for being on with us.
Alrighty, always. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Okay, fun.
Appreciate it. And then, yeah, we will, you will send.